The Gentleman Nerds is brought to you by the Dunwich Puzzle Company, maker of the fine, well-crafted, non-Euclidean puzzle pieces, now on sale at a dimension near you. And now we take you to the sublime and insidious Lobot Lounge.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Gentlemen Nerds, a gathering, a hodgepodge, a think tank of creative and intelligent folk who will gather and chat about all things nerdy. I'm Joseph Fotinos. I'm the current elected opener. Also with Gentlemen Nerds, we have Mark Finn. Introduce yourself and tell us a little about what you do.
Hey, my name is Mark Finn. I am a writer and an auteur, a raconteur, and a ne'er-do-well. I own a movie theater in North Texas that's too far away for most of you to drive, and I am a die-hard nerd.
Next up, we've got Michael Finn. Now, there is no relation between Mark Finn and Michael Finn. Michael Finn, tell us a little about yourself.
Actually, we're triplets. Don't ask about the third one. We don't talk about the third one. My name is Michael Ashley Finn, a.k.a. Mickey. I am a short story author attempting to figure out the DNA of novels. Been involved in many conventions on both sides of the invite list for many, many years, and have a background in radio, television, and film, and can't really match Mark's ability to own a movie theater.
Wouldn't we all like that? And also with us is Aaron De Orive.
Ooh, very good.
Thank you.
Nice.
And Aaron, tell us a bit about yourself.
Well, like the rest of us, I am a diehard, dyed-in-the-wool nerd. I'm also a writer, mainly in the screenwriting arena. Like Mickey, I also come from the radio, television, film background. I got my RTF degree from the University of Texas in Austin. And was going to go off and become, you know, the next amazing screenwriter, but as happens in 99% of those situations, it didn't happen. But I did start working for video games, and so most of my notoriety as a nerd comes from working on a variety of different online games, MMOs, massively multiplayer games, Star Wars, and the Metroid franchise being the two big ones that I've worked on. But also, I've written a novel. I dabble on trying to get back into screenwriting and doing another novel, so that's me.
Lovely, lovely. And rounding us all off, as I said at the beginning of this, I'm Joseph Fotinos. I am I was a television horror host for many years as Professor Griffin, host of Professor Griffin's Midnight Shadow Show. And I found it a little different when I did the character. I did that for years here in Austin and then again on Fangoria TV, a little national bit there. I'm a film producer, I'm an actor, I'm a writer, and I like spooky things. My specialty is in things that go bump in the night and reasons that you leave your nightlight on. So there we are. We're gathered together as gentlemen nerds to talk about all things that excite us, and we do it with such class and dignity and grace.
Joseph, you're going to be in the wheelhouse here because this being October, this is definitely the silly season for you. All of the ghosts and goblins and horror movies and Halloween goings on. Let's crack open this discussion. You know, we're all fans of horror in some capacity, and there has been a wonderful resurgence in horror movies the last few years, mostly the low budget variety. I guess if you really wanted to go back to the Blair Witch Project, that was the first time somebody did a $15,000 movie that made $1 zillion.
I would challenge that. I would say that go look at John Carpenter's Halloween, very low budget film.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
George Romero's and Russell Strider and John Russo putting in $1,500 of their own money to make Night of the Living Dead.
There's always been, I guess, a trend towards being able to do low-budget horror movies. And certainly, that's nothing new.
Yeah, Evil Dead.
But I think that Halloween kicked off a very different trend than the Blair Witch Project kicked off. You know,
I would agree with that. I think a Blair Witch Project is a really good one to sort of bring up for this current generation of certainly the found footage phenomenon, which is dying out a little bit,
Thank God.
But yeah, they're fans of found footage, and there are not fans of found footage. But I fall somewhere in between. If it's well done, you know, I'm there. I love it. But if it's not well done, wow, it can get really tedious, and I get motion sick and all that. But Blair Witch, Eduardo Sanchez was one of the co-directors of that, and he's still working in the low-budget horror arena, having, I think, most recently done Exists, which is the Bigfoot found footage movie, which I saw, which is really actually quite good. But I agree with Mark in that if we go way, way back, then yes, I would say Halloween and possibly even Black Christmas before that. But yeah, for this current trend, for what we're seeing now, the Paranormal Activity, Insidious, Sinister, you know, these kinds of franchises, it follows. I think really those are more the stepchildren of Blair Witch Project.
Well, I would agree with Paranormal Activity, since it's a, you know, monitored camera footage that we get to see. We were participating in that sort of voyeuristic look at these people's lives and
right.
all the things that happened to them. But Insidious, I believe, is just a movie. It is actually,
yeah.
It's got cuts, it's got different points of view, it's got...
Absolutely, yeah. No, I'm not saying that they're all found footage movies, but I think the interest, the resurgence in the... Hey, let's get a couple million dollars together. Let's do a low budget, you know, supernatural thriller or horror or something like that.
I think you said the right word. You said supernatural thriller. So really, what we're talking about here is a resurgence in the supernatural.
Yes.
So through the slasher films,
right?
Or monster movies, or the yes.
I mean, Paranormal Activity is a straight up ghost story. You know, the first one is. It's stuff moving on its own. It's, you know, for all intents and purposes, right up until the very end when we kind of get a sense that there's something more than just that. You know, it could be just a poltergeist. It's pulling sheets off the bed and opening drawers and making dishes rattle.
Yeah.
And, you know, I marvel at the fact that this is one of those times when you want the camera footage to be kind of crappy.
Right.
It works in your favor in that case. The supernatural stuff, after Paranormal Activity, there was another one that came out that didn't get as much play called The Fourth Kind.
I remember that.
And then right after that is when... Sinister and Insidious
and Saw
started and
Saw, yes.
Saw a little bit before that, yeah.
Saw, mm-hmm. I believe Insidious is actually one of the guys from Saw, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
And what struck me about those is how well done they were. I kind of went through a period in the 90s when they kept remaking movies badly. And just messing them up. Well, I mean, the best example I can give you is The House on Haunted Hill. The remake of that is just so pregnant with potential and bloated with regret that I feel so bad for Jeremy Rush. I understand everybody has a boat payment that they need to make every now and then, but he really should be ashamed of himself.
Well, Jeffrey Rush's portrayal in House on Haunted Hill, the remake, obviously, was... Supposedly not intentionally modeled after Vincent Price. It was actually more after John Waters. He
yeah.
was supposed to be the John Waters type character. But I'll be darned if he didn't look just like Vincent Price.
Oh yeah, yeah. That was inspired.
Yes.
But I
thought Chris Kattan as Watson Pritchard in that film was a standout.
Yes. He was the and he was the only one. And unfortunately, when you got to the end of the story, they just butchered the dismount. Like most of the stuff in the 90s, that you'd get these great effects, these wonderful little scenes, and then the movie would fall apart. With Insidious, with Sinister, what I found is that there's a narrative line that goes all the way through to the end, and what's even more interesting about it is whenever they do a sequel now, what they do is they go back and tell the prequel.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So,
and, you know, I have a theory. I have a theory about that because I completely agree with you. I think a lot of the movies, The Haunting is another example terrible, terrible remake.
Yes.
Right.
It's my favorite Haunted House book. And the Robert Wise version, the black and white version, is fantastic.
Yes.
So creepy.
The remake is the Liam Neeson version, right?
Correct.
I actually fell asleep in that.
Yeah. But here's the problem. I think at some point, especially when the special effects started really emerging around the 90s, that Hollywood became in love with, or whoever, the powers that be out there, became enamored of the effects. Mm. And it became less about telling us a great story and progressing that story and having us invest in the characters, which I would argue that Insidious and Sinister and things like that do. It goes back to that because they don't have the big budgets. They're not there to showcase special effects like the Haunting remake is.
Right.
They're there to tell us a really creepy, good story and really creep us out. And it works. That formula will work every time. You care about the story. You care about the characters. You're along for the ride. If it's just a special effects extravaganza, I personally could care less.
Yeah.
The remake of The Haunting was very disappointing because it was such a good movie.
Yep.
You know, they had the woodwork moving and morphing and changing and faces looking, and the original showed nothing.
Yeah.
It was the sound of that house, of the Hill House, settling and booming and things moving down the hall and cold hands in the dark, and you didn't see anything, yet you were terrified. That movie, a simple shot of an open door at the end of a hallway, is terrifying.
Yeah,
absolutely.
The sound design is brilliant. The sound design is absolutely brilliant.
Yep.
George Romero said this, and I'm going to quote him here because it pretty much tied up exactly what you just said, Aaron. He said that people expect that Spielberg-esque touch, that it's idiomatic now, that people go to the movies to see that. But he doesn't think that's essential. He says if there is a formula, it would be to have a good story and tell it in a way that's entertaining viscerally, period.
Hmm.
However that works out.
Okay. I have a really good example of how that works and how that doesn't work. In the case of Insidious, or maybe it was Annabelle, one of the prequels, there's a scene where a woman she's trying to get into her apartment building, and there's a dark shape on the stairs. And you can't tell what it is, but it's the thing that's trying to get her. And we know it's the thing trying to get her, but she doesn't quite know it's the thing trying to get her. All she sees is a dark shape on the stairs. And it's this scene that seems to last for 10 minutes. But it's really just a few seconds long, and it's just the most terrifying, because we've all seen the dark shape on the stairs.
Yeah.
You know, the lump of clothes in your bedroom as a kid all of a sudden looks like an alligator, you know. It's that kind of liquid reality that to me is where the best horror movies lie. Mm-hmm. And a good example of you mentioned Spielberg, and it took me right to Poltergeist.
Mm-hmm.
We advertised the heck out of Poltergeist and played it for the kids because
Are you talking the remake?
The remake.
Okay.
The remake, which came out earlier this year, I found that the adults, to a person, didn't like it. And the kids thought it was okay. They liked it, but they weren't scared by it. Mm. And I think the reason is because if you watch the trailer to Poltergeist, it literally shows you every beat.
Exactly.
It completely gives away the movie that was, you know, you don't know what's happening in the original Poltergeist until literally 5 minutes before the movie's over. And they stop the carnage and the chaos to tell you. Right?
Right.
I mean,
you brought up something good about trailers, and back in the day, boy, I tell you, they made specific trailers, footage that they would shoot just for the trailer.
Yes.
That was brilliant and frightening and terrifying.
Yeah. Amen.
My example, my favorite example of the glory of horror trailers in its heyday was the absolutely low-budget Coen movie, It's Alive.
Oh.
It's a story about a mutant baby
born
to the Davises.
Yep.
And the trailer of it, a complete black screen except a bassinet, slowly turning in dead center screen and some off-key music box music and a slight heartbeat if you listen carefully.
Yes.
And it's very quiet and it's turning and this voice says, "The Davises have just had a baby. The only problem is... It's alive."
Yep.
And at that point, as the bassinet turns, you see there's claws hanging out of the bassinet.
Yes.
On one side. And then the voiceover concludes with, "It's alive. Please, don't see it alone."
Oh, yeah.
Brilliant! And I chills just now, recreating it in my head. And as a kid, I'm diving behind the couch. I mean, there's no way.
Yeah. No, beautiful, beautiful stuff. By the way, I think we're all of an age that we grew up in that era, you know, mid to late 70s. And I remember the trailer for Jaws, where it's just underwater footage, and it's talking about this eating machine, and God gave the devil form and gave it jaws. And I remember the trailer for Close Encounters, where it's just that light over the horizon, and it's talking about the different Close Encounters of the first kind, Close Encounters of the second kind. I mean, they didn't give away the movie. They enticed you. They made you go, oh, I'm going to see this. Me and my friends are all going to come on Saturday. We're going to watch this movie. And that's gone.
The one that got me about the same time that It's Alive was out, there was also the movie Magic.
Joseph Mouth Magic, as you were saying that, Mark. It's amazing.
Abracadabra, I sit on his knee. Presto, change-o, now he's me.
And then
his little eyes would roll up into his head.
And the lids would close. And met a terrifying new motion picture strike, Anthony Hopkins.
Love it.
Oh, my gosh. See, in case anybody out there listening is wondering where the nerd part of this comes in, you just saw it and heard it in full display right there.
Just if you are playing the drinking game at home, feel free to drink.
When I was a kid and Salem's Lot came out on TV, and there's that infamous now scene you see it as a meme everywhere of the kid floating at the window, scratching at the window, wanting to come in.
Yeah.
Oh my God, that I slept with the light on for days and days after we saw that.
I got to tell you, that's my favorite part of the whole show, and probably I think the most effective scene in the movie, especially when the kid snaps the cross off of his Aurora model kit.
Yes.
Right? I mean, how cool is that, right?
Yes.
It shows you the nerds are going to be okay because we know what to do.
Yeah, there you go. When I was a kid, I didn't like the vampire makeup.
Really?
Also, David Soul, I had a problem with. But I don't know what it was. It didn't.
And are you talking about you didn't like the sort of the Nosferatu look of the vampire?
The fact that he was pale blue. There was just some stuff about it that didn't work.
I see.
Maybe the fact that because they were using, this was not the days of, you know, HBO, so they had to put that vampire in a pretty strong light to get him to show up. And I would have been great if he'd have been half in shadow, right? I feel like maybe they could have filmed him differently and made him a lot scarier.
His first appearance in that, and let me preface this by saying I saw Tobe Hooper's Salem's Lot before I read the book.
Yeah.
So I was quite surprised to read that Stephen King actually wanted Barlow to be the suave, handsome one, and Stryker to be the bald, pockmarked, hideous thing.
Yeah.
So he flipped them around. But as a kid growing up, Barlow was pretty terrifying. I mean, his first appearance in the prison, when he kills the Ned in the prison, and it's just fog and smoke, and you see his clawed hand, and then he pops into screen and doesn't say a word. The whole movie doesn't speak. He growls, he makes guttural sounds, and there's James Mason, of course, brilliant James Mason, speaking for him.
Yeah.
You know, back shaman, back priest. I mean, doing that whole conversation with the priest in the kitchen was
great. Yeah.
I don't know. I have an appreciation for Salem's Lot simply because it's unashamedly Halloween. It's over the top. A blue, bald vampire with little rat teeth and glowy eyes. I mean, there's some really nice moments in that, especially with, with the other vampires. Not Barlow himself, but the other ones.
Yeah. Right. You know, I agree with you. They did a lot with a little. Yeah.
Yeah. And I love the nod to the old Nosferatu look, because I think prior to that, although I was aware as a kid of Nosferatu, I'd never actually seen the movie. So I grew up with vampires looking like, you know, Christopher Lee and his brides and
or worse, you know, Frank Langella.
Right. I actually have
or Kiefer Sutherland.
Soft spot in my heart. Yes, a spot, a very soft spot in my heart for Frank Langella's Dracula. It's Elena's favorite as well. Just simply because Frank Langella is clearly having such a great time playing that character, and it's just an amazing portrayal of that character. Although he's not like that in the book.
No, it's a deconstruction of Lugosi's vampire. I mean, yeah. The whole thing is entitled to be it's a postmodern commentary. I mean, without a doubt.
And yet, when he's the scene where he's climbing down the wall, and he looks sideways at the camera with those big Frank Langella eyes of his, and then looks away, terrifying. And in that moment, you're like, oh gosh, he's not a human. He's not this handsome, you know, European. No, he's this monster that's crawling down the wall.
Now compare and contrast that to his performance in He-Man. And
oh Jesus!
I have not in a giving vein this day.
He was having fun with that too.
Yes, he was. But the Frank Langella Dracula from '79. I mean, obviously he recreated his Broadway success just like Lugosi did, mm-hmm. and it was in fact the same script, the Hamilton Dean John Balderston Dracula. Yep. That was the exact same script that Lugosi. Right. Did. The one that Langella did, of course, Edward Gorey did all the effects and the design of it, the look, traveled over into the film. There are some really good moments in that film, and Langella does, I think he does an adequate job. I mean, I think he creates a good mood for that character.
Yeah, he does a fantastic job. Yeah. By the way, in Salem's Lot, it was remade. I don't know if any of you saw the TV version.
We were fortunate to promote that for TNT as Professor Griffin back in the day. Yes,
nice.
Yes.
I enjoyed the remake. It had Rutger Hauer as Barlow, and he was, although he wasn't the, you know, suave, you know, well-spoken, you know, European guy. He was at that point, he was Rutger Hauer, who's going a little soft, who's getting a little big. but he does a great job with the character of Barlow as written by Stephen King. And so I really appreciated that version for that reason, that Barlow became the guy who was talking all the time suddenly. He didn't need the James Mason.
It was Donald Pleasance who played Stryker.
Yes.
Yeah. Thanks for saying that. You reminded me that I needed to add Buffy the Vampire Slayer to my top five comedy horror list. To push this back towards the modern stuff that we're talking about, that kind of got us off in this direction.
Right.
It's okay. I think because when you're talking about horror, I think it's those of you who are listening to this who are under the age of 25, there actually were movies before the internet was born, and sometimes they had to actually make the stuff out of mayonnaise and corn syrup. They couldn't just use a computer screen for it. So you can look that up. It's right next to Dinosaurs in the Dictionary.
And you know what? God bless YouTube, because there's a lot of the stuff that we're talking about right now that can now only be found on YouTube.
Oh, it's weird. Yeah. What I see, you know, talking about the things that we like and these little moments, there's a new generation of kids watching this stuff, and it's not just the found footage things. It's these really intense stories. I do feel like if we're going to talk about found footage, we have to mention M. Night Shyamalan's new movie, The Visit,
which I have not seen.
I'm going to recommend it to you.
Okay.
It's not The Sixth Sense, and it's not Signs, but I think it's definitely him trying to get back onto that firm ground.
Okay.
As long as it's not The Happening.
No, it's not. No, it's not that. But it is.
Did anything happen in The Happening?
No, well, not at all. Yeah, something happened. He took my money.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did, and he put it under a lawnmower. Uh-huh. There was a. The other nice thing about The Visit is it's a fair play mystery. And I can't really say anything else about it rather than
he funded that, right? I mean, Shyamalan paid for that out of his own. Like he put up the budget for that.
After the last two or three failures, he kind of had to, brother.
Yeah. Right.
But this is definitely a return to form.
Okay.
I'm glad for that because I think he kicked off something really special. You know, and I should say this: I am a big fan of his. I think he's a great storyteller, and I love the fact that I can watch one of his trailers, get a sense of the movie, but not have any of it spoiled for me. He doesn't give away any key shots. He doesn't give away any big reveals. He just basically gives you just enough to kind of set the hook. And even when I hate the endings, and I have hated some of his endings, I think we all have. Even when I hate it, I'm grateful that I got to watch the movie up to the point that he set the hook for me. You know what I mean?
Right.
Because not a lot of people do that. But I think that these new horror movies do a really good job of not telling you everything.
Right.
And I think it's because you've got a small group of the same guys doing this. I think it's a little early in the game to compare them to the maverick crew of people who were running around in the late 70s, early 80s. I'm talking Joe Dante and Larry Cohen and Carpenter and Landis and I think it's a little early to kind of and the last thing I would want these guys to do is start thinking that their poop doesn't stink. But I totally feel like when I look at those movies, I'm looking at sort of a much more coherent vision and viewpoint.
But, you know, can't you see the pedigree? I mean, I actually can see the pedigree in these younger filmmakers of the Cohen and Dante and Landis. And they grew up watching those movies.
And that's an important point because we have to acknowledge what came before, because if you know it and you see it again, you're like, oh, look at that. I know exactly where that came from. That's an inspiration. You could call it an homage. You can call it a complete ripoff, but it's there.
Right.
And we neglected to mention, in terms of classic low-budget directors and producers, our favorite Wes Craven, who passed.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Just a brilliant man.
Gone, but not forgotten.
Craven was one of a kind. He really was.
In fact, I remember when we had sat down, we didn't see Insidious in the in the movie theater. We sat down and we were watching it on, I think, Amazon or something. Mm-hmm. And as we were watching it, my wife and I are looking at each other and like, this is Poltergeist. This is Poltergeist. Yeah. But not, we didn't say that in a derogatory way. I mean, we're like, wow, bravo, that whoever made this
there
movie saw that, was influenced by it, and said, you know, I want to make a movie like that.
Right, I want to make my haunted house movie. Yeah.
Exactly. And I think actually Insidious is a better remake of Poltergeist than the remake of Poltergeist.
Oh, unashamedly, without a doubt, yes.
Now here's the question. The remake of Poltergeist, was it better than Poltergeist the TV series?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh,
yes.
So at least it has that going for it.
Yeah, I only watched a couple of.
Speaking of TV series, is anyone watching American Horror Story?
Yes.
I've got it set up. I have not started watching it yet. Okay. I'm going to get a few in and then kind of binge on it.
And so I'm sort of the same way.
No spoilers here, because I don't want to spoil my fellow nerds' experience. But I will say, there's a nice couple of nods to The Hunger.
Oh, in the new season. Oh, nice, nice. Yes, as someone had mentioned that.
Well, did you see the first episode?
No.
Oh, okay, you
did. We are currently halfway through the sideshow on the carnival.
Oh, you're watching
right.
The freak show.
Yes. So, but no. Somebody had mentioned, hey, you know, Lady Gaga plays a vampire in this new, and we're like, okay, well, we're gonna watch it.
Oh.
I think that's actually quite inspired. But I think American Horror Story has done some amazing stuff.
Yes.
For TV. Horror. In fact, I think we wouldn't have Hannibal, the TV show, if it weren't for American Horror Story.
I did not enjoy the witches, the coven. I did enjoy.
Oh, see, that's one of the few ones that I actually liked.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, it went a little. It was a little bit weird in the pacing. It was a little too young adult pacing type
right.
things, and less horror story. But they're changing tone each time. I didn't like the second season. We weren't sure about first season until the Halloween episode hit. Then boom, it had us. But like second season, what? And like,
I agree with you that Coven had a very young adult the craft kind of feel to it.
And there was no permanence of threat. They would die again. No spoilers. Characters would die one episode, and two episodes later they're back. Almost every single one, you were like, oh my gosh, I can't believe they killed that character. Don't worry, stick around, they're coming back.
Well, not only that, but they build up and they build up and they build up to the events of the final episode. But much like the Star Wars prequels, when the big thing happens that you're waiting for, oh, okay, it happened.
Yeah.
But, you know, really, Stevie Nicks' music video in the middle of that? I felt that.
That's where it almost lost us. Yeah. That is where it almost lost us.
But I do like the characters and what some of the actors got to play.
Yet, In the Freak Show one, we saw the episode where she sings the David Bowie.
Yes.
And it worked for whatever reason. In that scene, for us, it worked.
I wish they'd stay away from the musical numbers. I really do.
Yeah.
It takes me right out of it. It takes me right out of it completely. And I'm just like, oh, God, stop.
I liked it because it at that point it became this bizarre, surreal, like, phantasmagoric nightmare. Like this is not happening in any real place, in any real time. This is a nightmare that floats out there, and you're peeking in on it. So
it does make me want to do a mashup video of BBC's Life on Mars.
Oh, yeah,
that
sure.
Song.
on the strength of Jessica Lange alone, I'll watch pretty much whatever they're going to do, because I just thought she has been phenomenal.
Is she in the season?
No. Well, actually, I've read that she does make an appearance.
Okay. Because I heard she was retiring from the show. So.
Yes.
Well,
I love Jessica Lange. I wish she wouldn't retire. I mean, or at least maybe take a season off and then come back. That woman is just amazingly compelling to just watch. She
can't argue. It's been some of her best acting ever.
Yeah. I love Jessica Lange in those shows.
All right, I have you gathered here, so I'm going to test you very quickly on this. Joseph, you probably, well, I don't know, Aaron and Mickey, you may have known. There was a short-lived show on ABC in the 80, in the late 70s, early 80s called Dark Room, hosted by James Coburn.
Mm. I'm not
familiar with it.
Okay, all right.
I love the Army soldier story.
Yeah, okay, good. Okay, all right, there we go, good.
I haven't seen very many of them, but I did manage to catch a couple.
You so got it.
Like a night gallery kind of thing?
Yes, it was a night gallery kind of thing. And in fact, it had, I think, probably one of the best openings. You can find the opening on YouTube and check it out. It's pretty intense. As a kid, it scared the bejesus out of me.
What was it called again?
The Dark Room.
Dark Room. Okay.
One season. I think there might have been 12, 16 episodes. There's a couple of guys out there. Let's not call them pirates. I think privateer is much more appropriate, because these are lapsed copyrights that aren't currently being tended to. And so they have found a home on this privateer cruise. And for the low, low price of $20, he'll burn you a DVD that's got all of them on it. So, you know.
Nice.
Yeah.
You meet these privateers at conventions.
I'm betting you can find some of these on YouTube.
Yeah, there are a couple. Yeah, I think the first episode's on YouTube, and it's pretty good. I mean, they're very much in the night gallery, Twilight Zone type of vein. You know, sometimes they work and sometimes they don't.
And speaking of which, Joe Straczynski's remake of The Twilight Zone, the pilot episode was Shatter Day by Harlan Ellison.
Oh, yeah.
Directed by Wes Craven.
Yes.
Starring our favorite guy crawling around in air ducts.
Oh. Well, I got to check that out.
Absolute phenomenal cover of that.
Right.
Okay. All right.
I think for Night Gallery, it's what you keep mentioning, and my brain keeps going back to it. Yes. As a kid, that scared me. Those faces coming out of the frames, and the weird music and the colors, and it was just distorted faces is what that was. It was just really effective.
A lot of times those openings promised more than the episodes delivered.
Oh, yes.
Right.
Oh, yes.
And we've gone back. They're on Hulu now, and we've gone back and we've watched several of them. I found a guide online, and we watched every single episode that was ever based on a Lovecraft story. So that's how that started.
So you saw the Pickman's Model episode.
Yeah, I did. And clearly they found the Sleestak.
I thought it was the Creature from the Black Lagoon bodysuit that they
looked like a Sleestak to me, but in fact, when the ghoul came out and we saw it, first thing that Blythe, my wife, said was, "Oh, look, it's a Sleestak." Like, okay, well, yeah, but you're right. Maybe, who knows? Maybe the
because it was Universal.
The Sleestaks might have been based on the creature from the Black Lagoon.
But I think Night Gallery is produced at Universal Studios, so I wouldn't be surprised if they. Got that bodysuit.
It's got to be. By the way, one of the finest. We talked about this briefly on Facebook, but one of the finest designs of a creature ever. The Creature from the Black Lagoon. That is just so iconic. It is up there with all the greats, Frankenstein, The Mummy, etc. It's just brilliant. It's such a wonderful design.
Was it really designed by?
I will tell you, actually, the...
Millicent Patrick.
Did the creature. The ghouls in Pickman's model were based on the Virgil Finley illustration from the Weird Tales.
Really?
Yes. In fact, the Virgil Finley ghoul image is a very famous Virgil Finley image.
Huh.
Yep. And for those of you at home, drink.
So, but again, those shows were produced for, 50 cents, so it wouldn't surprise me if they were going through a bunch of old prop and costume trunks and said, hey, look, this'll work, let's put some feathers and fur on this.
Yeah, that's a fine tradition. I mean, even Babylon 5, which, granted, was made on a shoestring budget, but for television, was still pretty, good special effects going on. They raided the yesteryear closet for, spacesuits and stuff.
Of course, kind of had to, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. We're not out of the woods yet with the modern horror stories. There've been a few kind of larger movies out recently that have sort of escaped onto these new streaming mediums, which I think has absolutely changed the game in terms of distribution. I've been doing on my blog for the last couple of years a series of top five horror movie lists, and I've been doing it every October to kind of fill out a bunch of things. And I have found a lot of really amazing, really clever, really genius horror movies that maybe didn't get a traditional distribution route. So I was hoping we could all go in order and kind of recommend a few for anybody who might be listening. If you've got two or three that come to mind as being just really hitting that sweet spot for you.
I will say there's a movie that I saw on Netflix, and I don't know if it was a direct to Netflix. I think it may have been a DVD release, but I didn't see it until Netflix. Frankenstein's Army.
Yes.
And
that was a direct to DVD, yes.
It's just a super over-the-top, special effects-laden, almost Reanimator-like level of, oh my god, oh my gosh,
And can be found on cable constantly.
Is it?
Yes, okay. It is constantly on cable.
I enjoyed that film as late night popcorny as it was. I thought that was a lot of fun.
Cool.
I have one.
It's not low budget, but of course now streaming has also allowed us to enjoy a lot of foreign fare that we normally would not have had access to. But one that I saw a few nights ago, and we all loved it. And Blythe likes horror movies, but it's called Rigor Mortis. And it's an Asian film about a hopping Chinese vampire.
I love
that because Aaron recommended it.
And we were so pleased and surprised, and it was a joy to watch. They use so many tricks on how they present the vampire. The end is, I won't give it away, but the end is a bit of a cloister flux of what did I just see? Is it real? Is it not real? Anyway, watch it. It's really, really good. But one of the things that they did with the vampire, which I will spoil, as far as just the effect, they clearly filmed the actor, the hopping vampire, in a pool or submerged in water. And so he's hopping underwater. And then they filmed it and lit it really well. And then they just removed all of the bubbles and everything that would let you think it was underwater. And they have him moving that way down a hallway. And his clothing is floating around him like it would underwater. And he's got that slow, balletic kind of move. It's brilliant. It's brilliant. I'd have to rewatch it,
but I think the idea was that's when he's moving through a solid object down the hall.
Yes, I believe you're right.
Yeah,
I believe you're right.
And because normally he doesn't move like that, but every now and then something happens later where some other people are able to go through the solid objects, and it's fun.
Yeah, rare mortis, and it's very well done.
All right,
beautifully filmed.
I've got a couple that I'll throw out. One of them is this is a slow burn, but when it gets up to speed, it's pretty crazy. Yellow Brick Road.
Oh, yes, someone recommended that.
It's a very nutso kind of a thing. More recently, two came out last year that are readily available now. One of them's called The Babadook, and it's so good. And then the other one is called It Follows. And there's something about It Follows that I keep going back to, because this is the kind of premise that almost feels like like horror people sitting around talking about what would be scary, because the whole thing is a very simple premise, and I think that it's a universal thing. You know, I think we've all at one time or another imagined we were being followed, whether it was in a car, walking down the street, riding our bikes. Might have happened last night, could have happened 30 years ago.
It's happening right now.
Yeah.
It's inside the podcast.
It's the chicken heart. But this really plays on that kind of primal fear, that fight or flight response. And they never quite get around to explaining the wherefores of it. You know, I mean, it just sort of is what it is. And so I gotta admit, you know, I'm not a teenage girl having unprotected sex in a car, and the movie still scared the bejesus out of me. You know. And so
that's one of the ones I still have to see. We've not watched it yet. I've been waiting for the right opportunity, but you know what? It's Halloween month. I gotta watch it.
I was given a lot of build up on It Follows, and we all went to see it as a group, and I'll be honest, I was a little let down. I enjoyed it. I thought it was great, but everyone was promising me that this is the future of horror, and I was like, it was good, but I'm a big fan of rules in my horror. I like to know how this works.
Yeah.
And I like to know that we can beat this thing, and they had a whole segment of trying to beat this thing, and I thought, beating this thing. So it didn't, it had like 12 endings, which I thought, pick one and run with it.
Right.
It seemed not to know where it wanted to go.
Okay.
But effective. I thought it was an effective film.
By the way, I felt exactly that same way about Oculus. I heard so much about it, and people kept talking about it, and I love the concept of a haunted mirror. I love the concept of a demonic entity that lives inside of this mirror and has been around for a long time and corrupting many, many people through the centuries. And it was such a letdown. They went through, again, it's rules. They set up all these rules, and they went through all these machinations to try to get this thing to where they could somehow defeat it. And it was, at the end, it's pointless. Every single action that the characters took was absolutely pointless. It would have made no difference. They could have just laid there on the ground, and it would have made no difference.
Well, inspired by Beyond the Grave.
Oculus.
Joseph, actually, Aaron and I were talking about this a couple of weeks ago when we were hanging out at FinCon. We were on a panel together. Actually, Mickey, you were there too. And we were talking about, like, one of the ways to make ghosts scary is to have them not play by the same rules that we're used to, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, some of the reasons. I think that's where some of the Japanese films end up being very terrifying, like The Grudge and The Ring, because we don't know the rules for those ghosts, and apparently they can do more things like touch us and kill us and make our hair stand up when they run their fingers through it in the shower and just all that kind of creepy stuff. Mm-hmm. But I feel like some of these current successes are successes because they're breaking the established rules. Do you have a thought about that, or do you think that's a valid point?
Oh, I don't care. You can break your – I mean, you can set any rule you want, mm-hmm. but stick to it.
Yes.
Whatever that is, you can create the universe that you want to and make your ghost bright pink. I don't care, but – you know, and they chase you around with little cherries and things like that. You could do that and make a horror film, but you have to make sure
that's
that you
Pixels,
follow.
Isn't it?
I think it's called Pac-Man. Yeah, all you have to do is make sure you follow your own rules, and if you establish your rules, stick by them. I think Craven, our good friend Wes Craven, was a really big fan of that. He established things and let them play out.
Yeah.
They only went a little haywire at the behest of the studios, which he always grumbled about.
Right.
He liked a good happy ending. I'm not talking about, you know, never having a nice jump at the end. I like a good jump at the end, but still, if you've been invested in these characters and you follow them through this entire story, you want them to win. I'm okay with that. I rooted for the vampire hunter. I wanted Peter Cushing to kick Christopher Lee's ass.
Yeah.
I was that guy, you know?
Me too, but I do also, I think there is something satisfying sometimes about having things spiral out into entropy and decay. The Thing is a perfect example.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, if you want to get your cosmic Lovecraft on, those kind of downer endings, or those kind of endings where they end on the upbeat instead of the downbeat, right? There's one, as we're backing away from MacReady, mm-hmm. and Childs, we know there's one more downbeat coming, and we won't ever see it. And it's up to us to provide that.
Did you feel that one of them was?
Oh, no, I didn't think either of them was.
I didn't think either. I thought that they both were perfectly normal.
But that's the beauty and the brilliance of something like that. Yeah. This is where I draw the distinction. I don't mind nihilism. I don't mind a horror movie that ends with the monster still there or whatever. That's fine. But something in the story must have been changed by the actions of the characters. They don't have to defeat the evil forever. They don't have to, you know, save the day and get the parade and all that. No, the creature still exists. It's still going to hunt people. It's gone. It's moved on to some other place. It's,
right.
you know, whatever it is. Or you leave on that question, is Childs a thing? Is Russell's character a thing? You don't know. But I'm okay with that question mark, or they've defeated it for now. They've made it move on to something else, somebody else, whatever. But when it's pointless, when it's almost like it didn't matter what these people did, mm-hmm. they're still going to end up being food for this creature. Unless it's a fantastically told story, I'm going to be disappointed.
There's an on Breaking Rules. There's a Australian zombie movie called Undead that starts out, the first 30 minutes is a traditional zombie movie. Then it sort of moves into Evil Dead coolness, or Evil Dead 2 coolness, where we've got some really, you know, don't ask where he pulls that shotgun out of since he was naked type things. just some really cool characters. And then it goes off the rails into Outer Limits territory with the explanation of where the zombies are coming from. And it's awesome because they just go in a completely unexpected direction.
Nice.
I have to give a nod to Unexpected Directions and one of my favorite little low-budget horror films from the 70s, Phantasm.
Oh
yes.
John Coscarelli is my personal hero.
It's about what again? Yeah. You know, it's an interdimensional creature who comes to our planet and plunders its graveyards for corpses to send back to its dimension as slave labor. Really?
Really, really short slave labor.
Right.
Yeah. And by the way, I think that's an example, by the way, that Joseph gave of you can break rules. You can present us with a world that we are absolutely unfamiliar with, but make sure that you're consistent within the universe that you've created. Because I defy anybody to tell me what the rules are for the Phantasm dimension. We have no freaking idea.
But for setting up the characters, watch Star Wars. Because we have the Han Solo character with the fastest hunk of junk in the town.
Right, right, right.
The kid looks like Luke Skywalker. The balls float around like you know, something from Star Wars.
That's
right. And then suddenly it all goes weird.
And
it
then
all goes
we get to Ozzy. A whole 360 because J.J. Abrams named Captain Phasma after the balls in Phantasm.
Yes,
she wears silver
nice.
Armor.
Nice. See, how did I not? I just learned that right now. That is, I'm embarrassed that I didn't know that.
Audience, drink.
Revoke my nerd card. But no, Phantasm is the perfect example of a movie that I would one day like to do. Where it's just people are sitting there going, WTF, oh my God, but they can't stop watching. You know, it's like, what is this place? What is that thing? And just question. And you don't even really answer any of those questions.
That's Coscarelli for you. He's always been that guy, you know?
And you just go to Phantasm 3 and watch that as a fantastic sequel.
Well, John Dies at the End is
yes.
Another one of his newer efforts, post Bubba Hotep. And so he's still doing stuff. And it's still
John Dies at the End is great.
Yeah, it is. It's terrific. And it's got this really weird sort of there's kind of a meta to it. You know, this notion of that we're part of the narrative. I dig it a lot. I think Coscarelli's one of my favorite guys for when you watch a Coscarelli movie, you get Don's vision.
Yeah.
You get, you know what I mean? Like, this is what he, you know, that's why Beastmaster works at a time when all of the other sword and sorcery stuff was just terrible. It is. It's, I mean.
You're right. I cannot put my finger on it. I don't know why I like Beastmaster, but God damn it, I do.
Yeah.
Beastmaster 2.
It's Coscarelli. Well, now you keep bringing up the sequels, Mickey. You keep throwing that in there, and I have to tell you, if it's not Coscarelli, it's not going on the dinner table.
Did he do Deathstalker?
No, I don't think that was him. Was
that
him?
The magic of the sequel for Deathstalker is that they, instead of going with the big hero, they went with the rogue.
Right.
That's what made that movie.
Right.
Deathstalker. I remember he was kind of rapey, wasn't he?
Yeah. I'm afraid so.
As far as heroes go.
That whole slew. I mean, that whole slew of barbarian
Sword and the Sorcerer.
From the 80s. Yeah.
The Sword and the Sorcerer.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah, with the Witcher Ball as the wizard and the.
That's right. The three bladed sword
that shot that fired off. So.
Yeah, the guy.
Some propulsion.
The guy that's crucified on the table at the end and saves himself the way Ben Carson said Jesus should have saved himself by just pulling the nails off and just charging the Romans. Anyway, sorry. got a little political there, folks. Sorry, take a drink.
Now, if we want to fall down the fantasy bad movie things, there's also Hawk the Slayer.
Oh, Hawk the Slayer!
Oh,
yes.
God.
Which is, I promise you, is always better in your memory than if they have to watch it.
Yeah.
Oh, no. Low budget fantasy, that's another topic. That is another topic for another podcast.
Yeah,
but I have plenty to say. I have plenty to say about those movies. I grew up on the Barbarian Brothers and the Sword and the Sorcerer and all that.
All right, let's do this. We're getting close to an hour here, so we should probably kind of wrap this up. But I want us each to pick a movie that you don't think the other guys have seen.
Oh.
This will be kind of fun. And you can get weird, you know. Don't be afraid to get nutty. But I just kind of want to plumb the depths here and see where you guys are at. And we can do two or three if you want. So I'll go first just to give you an idea.
Okay.
How many of you guys have watched The Host?
Oh yes,
I have.
The Japanese
Korean.
Yeah, the Korean.
Korean.
Yes.
Okay, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right, there's my baseline. All right, you've seen those. Did you guys like it?
Yes.
Yeah.
I didn't hate it.
Did you? How many of you guys have seen Grabbers?
Yes.
I want to say that's like Tremors, but it's not.
It is. It's like Tremors, but with drunk Irish people.
Yes. I haven't seen it, but I know what you speak of.
Yes. Well,
highly recommend it. And don't read the description on Netflix, because the Netflix description blows it. You just have to basically just do the double click to get to the movie, because if you read any of it, they give away an amazing plot point that I've not seen in a movie, which is awesome.
Okay.
All right, final level here. Who watched Attack the Block?
I did.
I did not.
It's on my list.
Okay. All right. I loved Attack the Block. I thought they did. I thought Attack the Block had one of the most unique solutions for monsters from space that I'd ever seen, and it was let's take the invaders from Mars idea and put them in a situation where nobody's really likable. I mean, I don't know if I want every movie to be like this, but this was a wonderful change of pace from that typical thing. And
it was well done. It was very well done.
Highly recommended. Not a lot of money.
Low budget. Fairly low budget.
They spent it in the right place. And just to kind of take it back to Star Wars, the stormtrooper in the movie got noticed from Attack the Block. So.
Oh.
Nice.
So see how I tied it all up like that?
Very nice.
I have two.
All right.
One is called Infini, Infini. It was made in 2015, and it is a space horror movie, which when you start to watch it, you think, oh, I've seen this movie before, and the setup is very familiar. you know, group of Marine soldiers being sent into a ship that they've lost contact with, and there's some kind of, you know, infection or zombie-like plague going on in the ship. But the direction that they go with that plague and what happens, very surprising, very, very good. Infini. I highly, highly recommend it. It's on Netflix.
Have not seen it. Thank you. Good recommendation.
The other one is Starry Eyes.
No, I'm 0 for 2.
Okay, Starry Eyes. It is, in my opinion, it is a really well, low budget, well done updating of the Portrait of Dorian Gray.
Oh,
and when you see it, you'll recognize exactly what I'm talking about. Essentially, a young starlet wants her big break in Hollywood, and she is approached by a production company, like a Troma style production company that does a bunch of horror stuff. And they offer her the opportunity that she wants, but they are a devil-worshipping cult, and she has to become one of them.
Nice.
So very well done, Starry Eyes.
It's Dorian Gray meets Scientology.
Yes, actually, yes it is. And watch it. Very, very well done.
Meets Rosemary's Baby.
Yes.
all right.
And then just the last one, Rigor Mortis with the hopping... vampire, also on Netflix. Highly recommended. Those are my three.
All right, very good.
Nice.
Joseph?
I'm old school. I'm an old man. I like my horror the way God intended. so I'm gonna recommend some movies that you may have seen, you may not have. I think some of them are fairly obscure. There's a movie from the early 90s called Bad Moon, and it's based on a novel called Thor.
It is my favorite werewolf movie, by the way. I'm just saying that right up front. My favorite werewolf movie he just talked about right
now. Wow.
There.
And it's told from the point of view of the family dog. There's a mysterious uncle who comes into their lives. He's the lycanthrope. No spoilers there. It's obvious. But the dog knows. And the back and forth between the German Shepherd, the giant German Shepherd, and this werewolf in human form is... really good.
Oh my God, I gotta see that.
The way the dog looks at him, I mean, they take turns urinating on each other's stuff because it's like, no, this is my stuff. And the dog's like, no, this is my family.
Wow.
Very, very good. And the transformations are, let me back up. The transformation isn't as good as the makeup. The actual practical effects, fantastic werewolf.
Okay.
Fantastic. But it was in that era where they started to do morphing effects.
Oh, sure.
Somebody had a really good idea and said, let's morph him into the werewolf, and it looks horrible. But the werewolf itself is really good.
Okay.
Fierce, tremendously terrifying, brutal. Really, really well done. My second one that I will recommend is an Amicus film back from the good old heyday of horror in the 70s.
Sure.
Peter Cushing is in that, as well as Robert Powell. It's called Asylum. And it is a series of stories set in an asylum. A doctor comes to this insane asylum, and to prove his mettle, he has to determine which of the inmates was the former doctor who went insane. Stories. All the stories are written by Robert Bloch. All the stories are very effective, some more than others, but the mood of the piece itself is really twisted. It's a really, really one of my secret shames. I will stay up late at night and watch Asylum again and again.
Wow, very cool.
Asylum, subtitled House of Crazies. But yeah, that's a lot of fun. So there's my two.
All right. Mickey, what do you got for us?
I more like things remixed and not as God intended.
Okay.
So mine are a little off the wall. We've already mentioned Undead.
Yeah.
There's also Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are Undead.
Oh, wow.
Which
That's actually the name of the movie?
Yes. And it's not a great film. What it is it's a film obviously made by people having fun with some interesting characters, if you know any drama types, because they're trying to put on, I believe it's Hamlet that they're trying to put on.
Sure, let's do.
It's either Hamlet or Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead. I'm not sure. It's been a while since I've seen the film. But you've got all the personalities there, and there's a vampire floating in and out of things causing havoc. And then the other one is a more recent film from brought to us by the New Zealand Board of whatever.
Oh, well, what we do
in the Shadows.
Yes, wonderful film.
Very funny. A friend
I could
of ours
watch
brought
that
over.
Series. It
was hilarious.
It's Jermaine Clements was one of the guys from Flight of the Conchords, and several other guys from New Zealand that are just absolutely fantastic actors doing a fake documentary on vampires living in modern day as flatmates.
Yep.
And they have every type. They've got an Nosferatu vampire. They've got, you know, the modern Peter. Vampire. They've got, yeah. And it's just really well done. And they run into a bunch of werewolves. They're like trying to be all nice. You know, we're werewolves, not swearwolves.
Oh my god, that's a great.
It just kind of keeps going. It'll either annoy the crap out of you or you'll love it.
All right. All right. No,
it was so funny. In fact, one of the vampires in there we saw it just a week ago. And one of the vampires in there, the first thing I said when I saw him, I said, oh, that's Joseph. Joseph plays that vampire right there. Which, by the way, is one of the co-writers, co-directors of that movie. Yeah. And he is being considered, I believe, for the Doctor Strange movie.
Ooh. Oh.
He's a New Zealand actor. Wati is his name? Yeah. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I think he's considered, if it's not Doctor Strange, it's one of the big Marvel movies that he's been considered as a director for.
Very cool.
I thoroughly enjoyed it.
If they ever redo Babylon 5, which Joe Straczynski keeps occasionally saying, we're going to recast it and redo it. We've got Malari in the middle vampire, the one that we hadn't mentioned.
Oh, the Slavic-looking...
Leaning back in his chair, talking about stuff. He's got the accent and the attitude and the hair already. It's
funny. Nice.
Wonderful. You know what? I think we should probably, you know, head towards some sort of a conclusion at this point. I will say it's been a wonderful, wonderful pleasure. This has been a great conversation, and boy, I tell you, I'm in the Halloween spirit now, as if I wasn't before. But yes, I'm even more in the Halloween spirit. Gosh, what a great honor. Thank you so much for inviting me into this.
Absolutely. No, and we'll have shows where we're talking about all forms of nerdery. Now, most of it will be pop culture media related. We're going to talk about movies. We'll talk about probably maybe some video games and role playing games at some point. But yeah, just to be clear that we're not going to nerd out about science stuff unless it relates to that kind of stuff, or if it's something really amazing that, you know, we suddenly discovered life on a planet. Well, of course we're going to talk about that
right.
in an episode, but yeah, everything media and pop culture related.
Can we talk about how The Martian's not a true story?
Yes, we can talk about how The Martian is not, in fact, a true story.
We'll do that later. All right. Go ahead.
I guess until the next time we all get together here, gentlemen nerds, I'm Joseph.
I'm Aaron.
I'm Mark.
I'm Mickey.
And we want to say to you all, thank you so much for listening, and have a nice night.
Good night.
And all right. We're out. Very good.
We should probably think of a better sign-off.
Gentlemen Nerds is a production of Cloak & Dagger Studios, LLC. Music by Ben Gibbs. The sound editor is Michael Ashley Finn. Web design and cloakanddaggerstudios.com by Rustix Interactive. Promotional consideration by Voorhees Cutlery Emporium.